Monster Man, episode 372, Catableepus to Centipede.
Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games.
In today's episode, we're continuing our journey through Monstrous Manual, the 1993 supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 2nd Edition. Like a lot of Monstrous Manual episodes, this episode mainly covers monsters that we have previously addressed in their original forms, so unless there are big changes, I'm not really going to talk about it, though I do think that these are interesting monsters in terms of trying to infer what the kind of changes in the Monsters Manual's design philosophy was from the previous books, and maybe from there kind of the situation that D&D was in the early 90s, or at least what TSR thought it was, which may not be the same thing as reality. Before we do that, though, it's time to take care of some business. First, it's time to thank a new Patreon backer. Yes, this is someone who's gone to patreon.com/monsterman, and they've pledged as little as $1 a month to help support the show. And if, like today's backer, you pledge at the $2 or higher level, you'll also get my other podcast, Patron Deities, which is all about both the Deities and Demigods supplement, and religion and mythology in general. We're currently in the middle of a season on Egyptian mythology, plus nearly 100 episodes for you to enjoy as soon as you subscribe. So thank you very much, Apollo. It means a lot to me that you're enjoying the show enough to want to support it. In Pamphlet of Pantheons related news, we now have a distributor for print copies of the pamphlet. You can get them from Rooks Press, and I'll put a link down in the description. Okay, let's take a look at some of these familiar monsters and see what's new, what's old, and what we can maybe learn about where the game is going at this point. First up, we have the Catableepus. The Catableepus. I don't know actually how this is supposed to be pronounced. It's probably Catableepus, I would think, but maybe I'm wrong. Anyway, we've talked about this before and about its surprisingly complicated origins. It must be one of the very first episodes right back in season one, so it actually won't even be in the Patreon feed. You'll have to go over to Libsyn to check that out. I think that there are some quite interesting changes in language and more importantly, additions to this entry. When we go back and look at the Monster Manual, it says that this creature inhabits fetid swamps and miasmal marshes, while the Monstrous Manual says that it inhabits dismal swamps and marshes, which feels like a weird toning down of the specificity and kind of idiosyncrasy of the Gygaxian language, but not in the service of, like, brevity or clarity, because this entry is much longer, and I don't think that it necessarily communicates anything more. Not quite sure why that change was made. Maybe the idea is that miasmal would be a word that younger readers might not know, which is a shame because I think that the vocabulary of first edition AD&D is really a big part of its charm. I know a lot of people who will say that they were introduced to all kinds of words by first encountering them in D&D manuals. I mentioned that this entry is longer than the Monster Manual entry, but I don't feel like it really tells you very much. For instance, it talks about the different kinds of animals that it eats during the rare periods of its feeding cycle when it eats meat, which I was going to say it's fascinating, but it's not really all that fascinating. Like, it eats large amphibians and, you know, small birds and things. I don't know. It's one of those situations where it's very hard to imagine the possible circumstances where gameplay could proceed from this information, and if it did, how that gameplay would be satisfying. I would say that a game in which the, like, characters are playing wildlife researchers in the world of Greyhawk or whatever, you don't run into too many campaigns like that. You know, I guess maybe the idea is that if you roll a Catableepus on the Wandering Monster table for whatever, you know, the Miasmal Marsh encounter table, you know, the fighter can be readying their half pike, and then the druid, you know, lays a hand on her arm and says, "No, don't worry. It's merely out foraging. See, it's looking for eggs and invertebrates and large amphibians. if we just leave it alone, it'll go away. But that seems like a low likelihood event to have this text devoted to it. Here we get all this kind of like naturalism about these monsters, but it's not exciting or interesting. It's just, yeah, it's a big animal. It lives in a swamp. It eats swamp stuff. There's a sort of terror that a DM might be asked to invent anything, even if the information provided is no more colorful or interesting than what the DM would come up with by themselves. We'll talk about this a little bit later on, but I do wonder if there's a transition here toward aiming toward a slightly younger market, and I don't know if that's actually the case for AD&D second edition in the 90s. Right? That there are a lot of kids starting their RPG experience with AD&D 2nd. I mean, I'm sure there must have been. I bet that if you ran the numbers, AD&D 2nd was by far the most popular RPG of its era, and it is merely my personal background that makes me think that nobody was playing AD&D in the early to mid-90s, and everybody was playing Rifts and Vampire. Next, we have the Cave Fisher, another monster where the ecology section is much expanded, although here, it does lead to some fun gameplay stuff. So there's a fun, if gross, bit about how... So the Cave Fisher extends this long filament from its mouth, from its proboscis, and the filament is really light and strong, and they kind of dangle them around, waiting for things to run into them, but if they don't, they can also shoot them at you. And this light, strong filament can be, like, treated to remove the adhesive, at which point it becomes, you know, a very cool, lightweight rope. There's a little bit of gross-out stuff in there, but also a response to the perennial player question of, hey, if this thing is so cool, why can't we use it? So there we get some ecology, but some ecology that translates into something that the players might actually do or make a decision about. Next, we've got the centaur. Now, the centaur here is very much just, you know, another species of intelligent humanoid. Well, it's not a humanoid because it's got, you know, the extra legs, but however, the description of centaur society does actually take us a little bit back toward the centaur of mythology, because one of the things that kind of the traditionally the D&D centaur doesn't do is stand for what centaurs stand for in Greek legend, right? Because in Greek mythology and Greek art and literature, centaurs are kind of like uncivilized people. So they're barbarians, they're wild, they represent, if you will, an animal aspect to human nature. It's not really how they appear in D&D, they're just some people with horse bodies. But here it does say that they become, quote, rowdy, boorish, and aggressive, close quotes, when drunk, which is putting it mildly, but, you know, at least it's putting it. And finally, we have the centipede. Now, this is another omnibus entry. It combines four types of centipedes. The pincer-gnashing tunnel worm has been added to the centipede family. In Monster Manual 2, it was described as a cousin to the giant centipede, so here it's stuck with the rest of its cousins. So you got your giant, your whatever the next size up is, huge, your megalo, and your tunnel worm centipedes, which were previously three separate entries, right? One for the first two kinds of giant centipede in Monster Manual, plus one for the megalo centipede in Monster Manual 2, plus another one for the tunnel worm in Monster Manual 2. So three entries spread out over two books, now combined into a single entry. And I think this makes sense because I think that this is a better reflection of how GMs are actually going to use a book like this one. In general, I don't think people think, I'm going to use a tunnel worm in this adventure, I wonder what it does. Instead, people think, I want some crawling monsters to come bursting out of the hole, but what kind of crawling monsters? What size of centipede would be appropriate in this situation? And they don't want to have to use two separate hardbacks flipping pages back and forth to figure out which type of worm is best. Now, there's no perfect solution to designing these books because there will always be different ways in which people want to access this information. But from almost any viewpoint, I would say that this omnibus entry is better. It's still not super exciting, but centipedes, comma, whatever, are a meat and potatoes D&D monster, and these are an okay example of that. So I think we can see that there are sort of multiple pressures on the people creating Monsters Manual, or who created the Monsters Compendium that then got selectively turned into the Monsters Manual. And one is that there's a drive to combine and simplify monster entries that have been spread out over the series of three monster books plus Oriental Adventures and Greyhawk Adventures and plus Oriental Adventures and what have you. You kind of get them all in one place. And that seems to have worked out reasonably well. But so questions about like the layout and organization of the book, I think there we can see that they're doing something that makes a good deal of sense. But in terms of what's being included in the book itself, you have to be asking yourself who this is for or whom. There is a kind of, and I'm just thinking off the top of my head here, so, you know, maybe this isn't fully thought through, but I feel like the books are trying to achieve a sort of aesthetic of authoritativeness that comes from dumping detail onto the player to give the feeling of weight, of having been researched, even when that data is not actually very relevant to what the reader is going to use the book for. Many years ago, and then I'll stop. Many years ago, I read Lawrence Schick's book, Heroic Worlds, which is a history of early role-playing games. It's not a history, it's kind of a catalog, sort of a snapshot of the RPG industry up to the very early 1990s, probably maybe around the time this book came out. Well, actually, maybe a little bit earlier than that, but the early 90s is when I read it, because my local public library had a copy. Support your local public library. And in Schick's book, apart from all these kind of catalog entries for RPGs, there are interviews with different RPG designers. And one of them is with someone who wrote a thing for, I want to say, Mercenaries, Spies, and Private Eyes. It may even be talking about Top Secret or some other spy game. He talks about having written this scenario and then later on talking to another game designer about it and being kind of, you know, anxious about whether this other person was going to have liked it or not. And the other person says, I liked it except for two things. And he sort of, you know, his heart sinks. Oh no, what were the two things? And the guy says, you didn't say whether the VCR in the office was VHS or Betamax, and you didn't say whether the marble in the foyer was Italian or something else. And this suggests that for this writer, the stamp of quality was overwhelming detail. I mean, it also very specifically dates that conversation because there's only a narrow window of time where your VCR would be either VHS or Betamax. But who cares, right? Who cares? Now, there is something to be said for having a bunch of trivial detail in things. It's nice when you have this establishing moment. So there's there is a world of difference between saying there are pillars in the lobby and saying, you know, as you enter the lobby, the soft light gleams off the Italian marble pillars. One of them is a better piece of description, but it says something about what the designer thinks the GM's like. The assumption is that if you don't say it, the GM's going to write an angry letter to Dragon Magazine saying, hey, what does the Cataleptus eat? How can I run a game if I don't know whether it eats large amphibians? Rather than just saying, oh, it doesn't matter what it eats, I'll just make stuff up. And here, I mean, I believe that the GM should be encouraged to make stuff up in things that do matter, right? But I feel like there was a strong impulse toward that level of scaffolding, right? That the GM needed a lot of this kind of support. And that kind of leads to a house style that's verbose and dull and doesn't think about whether information is relevant. You're never going to look up what is it that a Cataleptus eats, right? It's just a soothing flow of words to show that the reliable people at TSR Hobbies, TM, the mark of quality, are on the case, and they know everything that there is to be known about Cataleptuses. Maybe under the right circumstances, you would find that reassuring. Anyway, that's about all the monsters that we have time for today. My $2 and up patron backers are going to get a new episode of Patron Deities in their feeds in the middle of this week, and then at the end of the week, we're going to have another patron request special episode. So I hope that you'll join me then for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening.
If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.